Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of October. This week, we are very pleased to have wildlife biologist Karen Holtrup joining us. Karen works for the Olympic National Forest and is here to speak with us about one of our most important native pollinators, the bumblebee. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Those of you listening may think that you know what the sound is, but there is much more to it than you realize. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you more about it. One of the things that I've been noticing most out there of late is the explosion of fruiting fungi of all shapes and sizes and colors. Mary mentioned mushrooms coming out a couple of weeks ago on her program, but I am now having trouble walking anywhere without stepping on some. I'm especially noticing an abundance of what I think are a species of slippery jack, which always remind me of golden flapjacks. They are not especially tasty, mostly due to their slimy skin. The spongy underside is beautiful, however, made up of thousands of tiny pores instead of gills. Mary mentioned that Winkler is her favorite mushroom book, but mine remains David Aurora's All That the Rain Promises and More, Pocket Guide, and its companion Bible, Mushrooms Demystified.
The other thing that begins with M that is happening right now is migration, especially of shorebirds. Our friend and stellar biologist and photographer Jeff Hammerson sent us a great photo essay featuring some of our current visitors, most of which are heading south after nesting up in the Arctic. They include the long-billed dowitchers, western sandpipers, Wilson snipe, greater yellowlegs, black-bellied plovers, and sanderlings. The shorebirds are often difficult to identify to species, but you should have no trouble picking out the visiting Heermann's gulls and their elegant slaty gray plumage and red bills tipped with black. These gulls are gradually making their way south, eventually to their nesting areas, mainly one island in the Gulf of California.
Jeff also sent us a photo of a possum that was taken at night on their trail cam at home in the woods just west of Port Townsend. This is the first of this exotic species that I have ever heard of here in Port Townsend, though we knew it was just a matter of time before they got here, as they have been recorded the last few years as close as Four Corners. Or perhaps you that live in town have already been seeing them. Email us and let us know. The last thing that Jeff sent us was an amazing little video clip that he took of a leafcutter bee taking a leaf into its burrow. He writes, quote, "These stingless solitary bees nest in pre-existing cavities, holes that they bore into soft plant stems or rotting wood, or in the ground. Females line their nests with round or oval pieces of green leaves or flower petals that they cut themselves. They are one of the most endangered of all animal groups in North America," unquote. Have you seen any leafcutter bees while doing surveys on the forest, Karen?
Yes, I have seen some leafcutter bees just this last August. I captured one, actually, when we were doing some bumblebee surveys. Leafcutter bees are interesting to me in that they carry pollen on the underneath side of their abdomen as opposed to on their hind legs like other bees do.
Huh. Hopefully some of you in our listening audience were able to make it to Tor Hansen's great talk last week, which was part of the Huntington Humanities lecture series, co-sponsored by the Jefferson County Library. He spoke on several fascinating natural history topics, but his most recent book is called Buzz, which is all about bees. He defined a bee as a, quote, hippie wasp. Bees evolved from wasps long ago, but took a different evolutionary pathway, becoming, quote, long-haired, flower-loving vegetarians, unquote. In other words, hippies, in contrast to the hunter-scavenger wasps. My guest, Karen Holtrup, has also been studying bees for the U.S. Forest Service, specifically native bumblebees. I think that Tora said that there are 4,000 species of bees described in North America, and probably lots that we do not yet know about. How many species do you reckon we have here on the Olympic Peninsula?
Well, I've read that there are over 800 bee species in the Pacific Northwest, and I think that there are close to 300 native bee species here. Not sure the exact number, but there's a lot out there, hundreds. As far as bumblebees, there are 17 documented bumblebee species on the Olympic Peninsula. Plus, there are an additional 5 species that range nearby that could be here. So altogether, there are 22 bumblebee species on my list that we look for. So, yeah.
It's amazing what you just see and you go, oh, that's a bumblebee. But who knew that there's so many different species, right?
Yeah, there's a lot. And we have a big proportion of the bumblebee species here out of about 50 species in North America and 30 in the Pacific Northwest. We have about 20 here.
Wow, that's great. So how do you define a bumblebee?
So a bumblebee is a bee in the genus Bombus. They are relatively large bees and have distinctive striped patterns, usually black and yellow, but sometimes red, orange, or white stripes. And they're covered with hair-like setae, which makes them appear fuzzy or hairy. So in other words, they're large and fuzzy and striped bees. Bumblebees are relatively easy to observe and identify. This is relatively, though, supposedly better than other bees. They're easy to identify.
Yeah.
But sometimes it can be hard.
Yeah. So what have you been doing with bumblebees on the Olympic National Forest?
We've been doing bumblebee surveys for the past 2 years on Olympic National Forest. We received funding to look for the rare western bumblebee, Bombus occidentalis, which is a sensitive species. The surveys were funded by our interagency special status sensitive species program.
That's a tongue twister for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. which is a BLM Forest Service program out of our regional office in Portland. But when we did our surveys, we wanted to identify and document all of the bumblebee species that we detected, not just the western bumblebee. So we found out more about the diversity and distribution of bumblebees on the Olympic National Forest. To do this work, we got help from the Xerces Society with developing the survey methods and with bee identification, specifically Rich Hatfield and Candace Fallon. The Forest Service has an agreement with the Xerces Society through which they help us with identification of invertebrates. I also got some help from the Student Conservation Association. I was able to hire SCA interns who helped with the surveys, and I just wanted to mention them. Hallie Lambeau from Wisconsin helped us in 2017, and Karen Guzman and Connor Kubit helped us in 2018. So those were our interns.
Yeah, they're a great resource. You've used them for a lot of different projects, haven't you?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So why should we look for bumblebees? Why are they important?
Many bumblebee species have declined in recent decades in North America and in other parts of the world. Possible reasons for decline include loss or fragmentation of habitat, pesticide use, climate change, or the introduction of pathogens that can cause disease. The decline of bumblebees, other native bee species, and of honeybees is an issue of global concern due to their importance as pollinators and their contribution to the agricultural economy. In other words, we need bees for many of our foods that we eat. We need bees for flowering plants in nature and in our gardens. And if you continue up the food chain, many animals, not just humans, depend on pollinators. They provide a vital ecosystem service. When we surveyed for bumblebees, we wanted to find out more about bumblebee distribution and their habitats on the forest. This will help us to manage for the native habitats and the diversity of plants for bumblebees and other pollinators.
What about the life history of our native bees? We always think of bees as being highly social because the bees that we know best, the commercial honeybees, are social. But I understand that most bee species are solitary, right?
Yes, that's right. Most native bees are solitary. In fact, over 70% of North America's bees are solitary. This means that the female builds and maintains its own nest, which is generally isolated from other nests, and there's no care for the larvae. The non-native honeybees and the native bumblebees are social, however. They live in colonies with a founding queen and her offspring. The female workers, which are the queen's daughters, help take care of the nest and the larvae. They go out and forage and gather pollen and nectar and bring it back to the nest.
And can I interrupt for a second and just ask you, a bumblebee colony, is there an average size for that? How large do they usually get?
So bumblebee colonies are smaller than honeybee colonies, and they can range anywhere from 50 bees to about 400 or so.
Huh.
And unlike honeybees, which live in perennial colonies, bumblebee colonies are annual, which means that they establish new colonies each year. After producing females, the bumblebee queen will produce new queens and males that will leave the nest to find mates. At the end of the season, after mating, new queens will overwinter underground, and then they establish new nests in the spring.
So more kind of like wasps, like yellow jackets, they're in their biology.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Do bumblebees produce honey? And how do they carry pollen? Dr. Hansen was describing how some bees have special pockets on their back legs to carry pollen. And when the bees have been visiting different types of flowers that have different colors of pollen, the bees end up looking like they have thick leg warmers on with stripes of different colors layered on their legs.
Now that you say that, they do kind of look like leg warmers. Bumblebees do not produce honey, but they are important pollinators. The females carry pollen in baskets. Pollen baskets, also called corbicula, which are flat, bare areas on their hind legs, like you said. When we do our bee surveys and capture bumblebees, we often can see masses of pollen on their legs. Sometimes they're quite large.
You know, I was looking online and I saw how large those clumps of pollen
yeah.
are. And so do the males not?
No.
Oh.
No, just the females. They're the workers. They're the ones that gather the pollen. Just the females have pollen on their legs.
Huh. So please tell us more about our rare Western bumblebee.
So the Western bumblebee, Bombus occidentalis, was once common and widespread in Western United States and in Western Canada. But since the 1990s, populations have declined sharply, especially in the western part of its range, from southern British Columbia down to central California, basically west of the Sierra and Cascade Ranges. The Western bumblebee population has been confirmed in just the past few years here on the Olympic Peninsula. There's been recent documented records at Hurricane Ridge, Mount Townsend, near Port Angeles, on Protection Island, and near Squim. So Western bumblebees are out here on the peninsula, and they have been sighted at various elevations and habitats, but these have been very rare occurrences. As far as what they look like, the Western bumblebee has a distinct white rump. The end of its abdomen is very white, not pale yellow, but white. And then the front of the thorax is yellow, and typically the rest of the thorax and abdomen are black. But there are different forms, so this varies somewhat. I think the most distinguishable characteristic is the white rump.
What did your surveys reveal?
So on the Olympic National Forest, we surveyed over 20 sites across the forest in various open habitats, such as alpine and subalpine meadows, wetlands, dry forest openings, and roadsides. The survey areas were in the Dungeness, Big Quill Scene, Skokomish, Wenatchee, Soldek, and Quinault watersheds. So they were basically all over the place. Mm-hmm. We documented a variety of host plants and bumblebee habitat occupancy. We identified 11 species of bumblebees. The most abundant species were Bombus flabifrons, which is the fuzzy-horned bumblebee, Bombus mixtus, also called the yellow-head bumblebee, and Bombus vosnesenskii, which is the yellow-faced bumblebee. The most wide-ranging was flavifrons, the fuzzy-horned bumblebee. This species was detected in just about every survey and in a variety of habitats. Other species were found in just certain habitats, such as Bifarius, also called the two-formed bumblebee, which we found at higher elevation sites. We did confirm the western bumblebee both in 2017 and in 2018 at one site on Mount Townsend. And then we had some citizen science reports of the western bumblebee in the Dungeness at Tubalcaine and at Boulder Shelter. And we were unable to confirm these reports, but we will continue looking.
If people think that they've seen one, should they call the forest or?
Yes, they can call the forest in Quilting and let me know or email. I actually have some signs at trailheads in the Dungeness, and it has my email on it and the phone number to call.
Great.
And we really appreciate reports from citizens about bumblebees and other species.
Well, and people are always up there looking for flowers, so it's natural that they would carefully look at what's pollinating them, too.
And in fact, generally speaking, citizen science has been an important part of getting information about bumblebees. There's a project that the Xerces Society and the states started just this past year called the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas. The Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas is a project in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho where citizens receive training from the Xerces Society, and they go out and conduct surveys and then submit the results online at bumblebeewatch.org. So I think that the Xerces Society and the states have been acquiring a lot of data about bumblebees across the landscape on different land ownerships.
Oh, great.
Yeah, because of the Citizen Science Project. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it's really good.
So how exactly do you do a bumblebee survey?
Well, the first thing that we do is we select survey areas that are open and have flowering plants. The survey areas are about 1 hectare or 2.5 acres in size, such as a meadow, or sometimes they're more linear area along a road. Roadside areas are pretty good, actually. I worked with our botanist, Cheryl Bartlett, a lot when selecting survey areas because, she knows where the flowers are.
Yeah.
And then once we select the areas, we search the 1 hectare area for bumblebees for 90 minutes. But this is 90 person minutes, so if there are 3 people surveying, each person searches for 30 minutes. If there are 2 people, each person searches for 45 minutes, and so on. So the time depends on how many people we have surveying. Our surveys take place in good weather conditions, June to August. And then during the survey, each bumblebee is captured with a net and placed in a vial. We use plastic vials, but you could use other containers, a small jar or something. And then the vial with the bumblebee in it is placed in a cooler with ice. This enables the bumblebees to cool down and enter a state of torpor. So at the end of the 90-minute search, we can easily look at the bumblebees. We can take them out of the containers and we can look at them without them flying away.
I loved it when you told me about this. I mean, I can see a cooler. People are thinking, they're bringing soft, cool drinks. And instead, there's just all these bumblebees
lined up. Yeah, it's for our survey. They're not drinks in it. And when we look at the bumblebee, we try to identify each one. And while each bee is slowed down, cooled down, we can photograph it. And so each one is photographed from several different angles, the top, the side, the head, thorax, abdomen. And that way, if we can't identify it right there in the field, we can do it later by looking at the photographs, or we can submit the photos to the Xerces Society to confirm the identification.
It's such a much more humane way of identifying. I mean, in the old days, let's see what this beautiful thing is. You put it in the little kill jar and pin it to your tray, and it's just so awful.
Yeah, I like doing it this way.
Yes.
Photographing, we have to make sure that we have good light and good cameras, but I like doing it this way. So then after the bees are out of the cooler, they slowly come to life and they fly off. And it's fun seeing them doing that.
Yeah.
Bumblebee surveys is fun. It's been a lot of fun out there capturing these animals and looking at them. So basically, all you need to do a survey is a cooler with ice, containers, and a camera. And we also GPS each survey location and record the weather conditions.
Do you also market for botanical survey? Do you notice what plants are?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question. We also record what plant species that each bee is on when we capture it.
Uh-huh.
And if we can't tell what the plant is right then and there in the field, then we take pictures of it also.
Uh-huh.
Cheryl helps us with that.
Yeah.
Our botanist.
Yep. Great.
And I just want to mention the Xerces Society again. Rich Hatfield came out in the beginning of our bumblebee survey effort in 2017, and he gave a little training, so that helped a lot. He helped us with BID and survey methods.
Great. So have you worked with other pollinators too?
Yeah, we have done some surveys for butterflies, particularly monitoring the Taylor's checkerspot butterfly, which is a subspecies of the Edith's checkerspot. And it's listed under the Endangered Species Act. So maybe I can tell you about our butterfly surveys sometime.
Oh, I would love that. Yeah, you'll come back and tell us about the butterfly surveys. Well, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about bees.
You're welcome.
And we'll all keep our eyes peeled for those western bumblebees and just know to appreciate all the rest of them so much more.
And
we have a multitude of fine upcoming natural history events to tell you about. First, the Jefferson Land Trust is hosting a forum on working forests this Thursday, October 11th. Join them at 5 p.m. at the Madrona Mind Body Institute at Fort Worden, or go to saveland.org for details.
The Port Townsend Marine Science Center has two events planned for this weekend. First, on Saturday, October 13th, is one of their fall migration cruises to Protection Island from 1 to 3 p.m. If it wasn't October, maybe they'd see western bumblebees.
Yeah, that's right.
Then, because they've been spotted there. Then on Sunday, October 14th, join them for the first lecture of the popular Future of the Oceans lecture series for this year. This Sunday's talk will feature Dr. Charlie Erickson speaking about his research on ocean circulation and will be held at the chapel at Fort Worden at 3 p.m. Go to ptmsc.org to learn more about these events and to register for the cruise.
The Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society has a program planned for next Tuesday, October 16th, exploring the biology of seeds and the science of seed banking. Join them at the Port Townsend Community Center starting at 6:30 p.m. for social hour, followed by the lecture at 7 p.m.
Next Wednesday, October 17th, join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society for their monthly meeting and lecture, Understanding Shorebirds, the Miracle of Migration. Meet at the Dungeness River Audubon Center from 7 to 8:30 p.m. or go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for details.
And finally, next Thursday, October 18th, join the Admiralty Audubon Chapter for their monthly meeting, lecture, and slideshow on the birds of New Zealand and Hawaii. Meet at the Port Townsend Community Center at 7 p.m. or go to admiraltyaudubon.org for more information. And here's our mystery sound again. So you all thought that this was merely the sound of a bee buzzing, right? Well, you would be wrong. It's much more than that. It's the sound of buzz pollination. Do you want to tell us a bit about that, Karen?
Sure. So when a bee vibrates its flight muscles, this is buzz pollination. It actually vibrates its muscles to dislodge pollen from the flower. Sometimes a flower has adapted, for example, tomato plants, so that the bee can't reach it with its tongue or its leg. So the bee vibrates to release the pollen, and the pollen is expelled out onto the bee. real interesting, I think.
For those of you in the listening audience, you should go search, and there are several little clips on bees doing that, these great little video clips on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And when I saw and heard it, I realized that I've heard that countless mm-hmm. times, but I kind of thought that it was that the bee had gotten trapped in the flower somehow, that it was trying to find its way out. But instead, it's actually doing this for a very specific purpose.
Yes.
And it's only bumblebees and certain species of solitary bees that do it, right? Honeybees don't do this.
No, I don't think honeybees do it. There's just a few species that do, some bumblebees and some other bees, like you said. Yeah.
And online, they were saying it's the pitch also of the vibration, that you can do the same thing with a tuning fork. In middle C, a tuning fork will cause the plant to release pollen also.
Wow, that's interesting. I should go try it.
No, I mean, they did online. They mm-hmm. had the tuning fork, and you can see the flower releasing. And there's certain, I mean, they're very important members of our food plants that are...
Yeah, like tomatoes, for example. And I think blueberries as well.
Potatoes. There are several families that it has to be a bumblebee or a solitary bee that performs this buzz pollination before they will release pollen. So it's an amazing world out there if we just pay attention.
Yep, that's right.
Yes. So that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of October. Thanks so much for joining me, Karen.
And thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails.
Why should you want to know? Don't you mind about the future?
Let me try to cool Danny Fish. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.